Most of your possibilities for success and achievement in life will come by owning or working for private business organizations. President Calvin Coolidge once said that the business of America is business. There are more than 18 million businesses in the United States today, and somewhere between 600,000 and 1 million new businesses are being formed every year. These businesses run the entire gamut, from the smallest sole proprietorship working off a kitchen table to the largest corporate organization employing hundreds of thousands of people. Our business system is very much a part of our way of life, and your ability to understand how it works can be an essential body of information for you. This knowledge can help you to be far more successful than people who never take the time to learn. The rate of change in businesses is accelerating. It's the one unavoidable and inevitable fact of modern business life. Between 1980 and 1990 alone, 157 companies fell off the list of the 500 largest companies in America. More than 100 additional companies were either broken up, merged, acquired, or changed their major line of business. When we experience that much turbulence amongst the largest and most powerful corporations in the country, you can imagine the kind of turbulence that's being experienced amongst the millions of smaller companies. Fully 80% of new businesses overall fail within the first 2 years of startup, and many large established companies go bankrupt or are taken over by other organizations every year. Also, many new companies succeed, and many larger companies grow at tremendous rates despite their size. There are opportunities everywhere for you to make a significant contribution to your organization and thereby put your life and your career onto the fast track. In this session, you'll learn some of the laws and principles at work in business and how you can use them to your best advantage. My business career began when I started selling soap for the local YMCA at the age of 10. From there, I went on to selling newspapers and lawn mowing services and Christmas trees and working in a department store. I went on to selling office supplies from door to door and through selling investments in real estate and automobiles and advertising, training, and consulting. I have worked in, sold, or managed small and large organizations over the course of more than 25 years, and I've seen both exciting successes and spectacular failures. By applying some of the laws and principles contained in this session, I managed and operated tens of millions of dollars worth of companies, products, and projects. My final job in the private sector, before turning to managing my own business full-time, was as a chief operating officer of a $265 million company with $75 million in annual sales. I've seen many kinds of businesses, from the most well-thought-out to the most ridiculous. I've worked with virtually every kind of business person, from the most accomplished and skillful to the most foolish and self-deluded. I've read hundreds of books and thousands of articles on various aspects of business and business management, and I still believe that I'm only scratching the surface. Nonetheless, I've picked up a few pointers that have been instrumental in enabling me to build successful businesses of my own and to help many of my clients dramatically improve their rates of growth and their market shares and their profitability. There are 14 laws that apply specifically to any business. You're practicing just one of these laws in conjunction with some of the other laws we've talked about, where you may not have in the past, can make all the difference to your long-term success. The first law of business is the law of purpose, as it applies to business, which says that the purpose of a business is to create and keep a customer. Many people think that the purpose of a business is to make a profit. However, while that may be the purpose of the individual who starts or invests in the business, a business is really a separate entity, and it has a purpose of its own. In fact, a good way to assess the reason for the existence of a business is to imagine that the owners of the business had to appear in front of a tribunal each year and make a case to justify getting permission for the business to carry on. You'll see immediately that making a profit wouldn't cut any ice in terms of the business making sufficient enough contribution to justify its continued operation. The first part of the law of purpose says that profits are a measure of how well a company is fulfilling its purpose. Since the purpose of a business is to create and keep a customer, how well the organization and everyone in the organization contributes toward the achievement of that purpose will determine the level of profit that the company enjoys. You can tell that customer creation is the purpose of a business by looking at the fact that the time and attention of the most important people in a successful company is usually focused on the customers of the company. The financial results of the company are simply used as a measure of how well the primary purpose is being achieved. The second part of the law of purpose in business says that profits are a cost of doing business, the cost of the future. There are many people who are confused about profit, some of them considering a profit to be a mark of greed, and many nations have been literally ruined by their confusion over this point. Profits are good. It's profits that pay for everything. It's profits that pay wages and salaries, taxes, investment in new products and processes, research and development, and all the many constructive things that a company can do when it's serving its customers well. The opposite of profit is loss. And where there is loss, there are layoffs, reductions in economic activity, and often the collapse of the business. Where there are losses in businesses, there's no future for the people who work there. Anyone who is opposed to profit is simultaneously, whether they know it or not, opposed to the future of all the people who depend upon that business for their livelihoods. These people can't have a future where no profit exists. Some people feel that profits are too high. Over a 70-year period from 1920 to 1990, the largest companies in America have averaged annual profits of approximately 5% per year. Of the total expenditures of most companies, aside from raw materials for manufacture or goods for resale, almost 85% of all costs are wages for the people who work there. Wherever a society has lots of profitable companies, it has lots of well-paying jobs and great opportunities for the future. On the other hand, the most impoverished and depressed countries in the world are those where the profit motive has been denigrated to the point where nobody makes very much of anything. In those countries, the opportunities and possibilities for the average person are almost non-existent. The second law of business is the law of organization, which says that a business organization is merely a group of people brought together for the common purpose of creating and keeping customers. A business organization begins to form when the jobs associated with serving customers become too great for a single person. New jobs are then created and new activities are engaged in. This growth process continues as long as the increase in people increases the number of customers that are satisfied profitably by that organization. The third law of business is the law of customer satisfaction, which says that the customer is always right. The very best companies in America are built on this philosophy. As Tom Peters said in his book, In Search of Excellence, the very best companies and the very best people in those companies have an obsession with customer service. Worldwide, the most successful companies are those for whom the customer is king or queen, and customer satisfaction is the driving force of all their activities. The first comment on the law of customer satisfaction says that all customer satisfaction comes from people. You can't satisfy people with machines or with pieces of paper of any kind. People are intensely emotional, and therefore they can only be pleased in their buying activities when dealing with other people. For this reason, the most successful companies have very clear customer policies, and everyone within those organizations is committed to treating the customers well. For example, the Walt Disney Corporation hires thousands of college students to work at the Disney theme parks in the summertime. These students are hired in the middle of May and trained for 4 to 6 weeks in their functions. They then work for approximately 8 weeks of the summer season when children are out of school. When the Disney people are asked why it is that the students receive such rigorous training for 4 to 6 solid weeks to only work for 8 weeks before going back to school, their reply reveals a lot about the Disney philosophy toward customers. The Disney managers explain that the students are drilled in their jobs to the point where they can do them virtually without thinking. The aim of this is to allow the students to pay more attention to their guests, as they call the visitors to the theme parks. Because the students have memorized their jobs completely, they are more conscious of the small things that they can do to make people happy that they've chosen to come to a Disney theme park. The second comment on the law of customer satisfaction is that the best companies invariably have the best people. The best companies learned a long time ago that 95% of their success will be determined by the people they select. They therefore take a long time to hire people, and they're very careful in both interviewing and in checking references. Once a person's been hired, if it's the wrong person, he or she can cause a great deal of harm before he or she is encouraged to go somewhere else. As you evolve into management, you learn that your biggest successes will come from having chosen the right people for the key positions under you. The third comment on the law of customer satisfaction is that the key role of management is to achieve the maximum return on investment in human resources towards satisfying customers. Any manager has two choices with regard to any job. The manager can do the job himself, or the manager can get someone else to do it. The job of the manager is to act as a multiplier and to get things done through others rather than to do it himself or herself. One final observation on customer satisfaction. The staff of a company will always treat the customers the way the management treats them. Whenever you're treated especially well by people in any store or restaurant, you know that that place has a good manager who treats the staff well. Whenever you're treated poorly for any reason, you know that the person you're dealing with is usually treating you this way in an attempt to get back at a manager who they feel is treating them badly. The fourth law of business is the law of the customer. It says that the customer always acts to satisfy his or her interests by seeking the very most at the very lowest possible price. Customers are economic in that they seek to maximize their resources and to minimize their costs or outlays. Customers follow the law of expediency in that they attempt to get the things they want the fastest and easiest way possible right now with no concern for secondary or long-term consequences. Now, this is a fact of business life. It's not a problem. In business, you're continually faced with both facts and problems. Facts are inevitable and unavoidable parts of life. They're things that you accept and work around. They're like immovable objects. A problem, on the other hand, is something that you can solve. A problem is something that's amenable to your intelligence and imagination. It's very important in business that you separate facts from problems and that you don't become upset or anxious over something about which you can do nothing. Before you get concerned about something that has or has not happened, ask yourself, is this a problem or is this a fact? The first part of the law of the customer says that customers are both demanding and ruthless. They'll reward highly those companies that serve them best and allow to fail those companies that serve them poorly. It isn't that customers don't care about a particular business. It's just that customers care about themselves and their own satisfactions even more than they care about the success or failure of an enterprise. Whenever you see a business fail and shut down, you see a business entity where the owners were either unable or unwilling to adjust their actions to serve enough customers at prices that allow them to carry on. The customers just silently walked away, told their friends, and never came back. The second part of the law of the customer says that customers always behave rationally in pursuing the path of least resistance to satisfy their most pressing needs. From the point of view of the customer, every action makes perfect sense. All her behavior is aimed at achieving greater personal satisfaction, toward improving her position. The customer is very smart and always knows what is in his or her best interests. The customer's decision is always rational. The customer is always right. And when you go into business, you put your entire financial future at the mercy of satisfying the customer every single day. From the moment you open your doors, the customer determines what you will sell, how much of it you will sell, at what price you will sell it, and how much money you will make. It's only by catering to the customer's whims and fancies that you'll be able to survive and grow in business. The third part of the law of the customer says that proper business planning always begins with the customer as the central focus of attention and discussion. There's a dangerous tendency for people within companies to lose touch with the real thoughts, feelings, and needs of their customers. They tend to talk to themselves too much, and what's worse, they listen to each other and they begin to become divorced from reality. If you're in business and if what you do affects the customer, you should mentally erect a statue of the customer and place it in the middle of the table when you discuss what you're going to do with regard to your products or services. Always ask yourself, if the customer is sitting here listening to us, what would the customer be thinking? What would the customer say? Would the customer approve or disapprove of what we're planning to do? By the way, the subject of the customer is very important. Some people within organizations have the mistaken idea that they have no customers because they don't interact with the person who buys the product or service from the company. This can be a fatal mistake to success in your work life. The fact is that everyone has a customer, and many of you have several customers. Your primary customer is the person who determines your success in your job. By this definition, unless you're the boss, your number one customer is your boss. It's whether or not you satisfy your boss that determines how far and how fast you move ahead. If you're a manager and you have people working under you, your staff are also your customers. It's how you satisfy them that will determine how they satisfy the people who must use what your department produces. If you work in accounting or administration, your customers are the people who must use what you produce, whether financial statements, computer printouts, or other information. Everyone has a customer. Everyone is in the business of customer satisfaction. Everyone's level of success in life is determined by how well they satisfy the most important customers they have. The fifth law of business is the law of quality, which states that the customer demands the very highest quality for the very lowest price. This seems simple enough, except that many companies try to violate this law on their way to the bankruptcy courts. The customer is very smart. The customer will always act to satisfy the greatest number of possible needs in any particular buying decision. It's only companies that cater to the customer's incessant need for ever higher levels of quality that are successful in the marketplace. For example, in 1989, both the Toyota Lexus and the Nissan Infiniti were released for sale in the United States. Both companies advertised these cars as the cars of the future, with every luxury feature of the more expensive European cars, but at prices that were $10,000, $20,000, or even $30,000 cheaper. Both companies committed themselves to building the finest quality automobiles in their class in America. In 1991, the J.D. Power Survey of Customer Satisfaction came out with its results on all 557 models of automobile sold in the United States. According to their rankings, the Lexus and the Infiniti were tied for first place in quality amongst all cars sold in the country. As a result of this quality ranking, and even before it came out, because of their commitment to quality, the sales of these cars had taken off into the hundreds of millions of dollars. The first part of the law of quality says that quality is what the customer says it is and is willing to pay for. Only the customer can define quality. Sometimes the customer can't even define it clearly, but the customer will vote for quality by the way he or she spends his or her dollars. Philip Crosby, in his book Quality Without Tears, wrote that quality is fairly easy to define. The quality of a product can be measured by what percentage of the time it does what it is sold to do and continues to do it. In other words, you can measure the quality of a watch by how long it continues to tell perfect time. If it does so 100% of the time for the indefinite future, then it has a 100% quality rating. If you buy a car, The quality rating of that car is how long it continues to give you trouble-free service without needing repairs aside from those specified at the time of purchase. If the car runs trouble-free for 100% of the time, then it has a 100% quality rating. Unfortunately, it's not uncommon for fully 25% of products manufactured in some plants today to have to be reworked and rebuilt right at the factory because of quality defects. Philip Crosby's other book, Quality is Free, points out that manufacturing a high-quality item without defects actually saves money and boosts profit, both in the short term and in the long term. In the short term, it's quality that creates customers, and in the long term, it's quality that keeps customers. The second part of the law of quality says that quality refers both to the product or service and to the way that it is sold, delivered, and maintained. Quality actually refers to all of the activities associated with the purchase, ownership, and possession of the item. For example, prices in a quality restaurant are not based only on the fact that it's good food that's served on the plate. A high-class restaurant, one that commands above-average prices and which can earn above-average profits, also serves the food in an atmosphere of comfort and enjoyment that people are willing to pay more for. Even a simple product can be sold and served with cheerfulness and courtesy, thereby increasing its perceived value. The customer defines the total experience, both product and service, as all being part of the impression of quality. The third part of the law of quality is that companies are financially successful in direct proportion to their quality ranking as customers perceive it. What this means is that if a market researcher were to go into the marketplace and conduct an honest, objective survey amongst customers and other companies, it could come up with a ranking for your company in terms of how it compares to your competitors. For example, suppose there are 10 companies doing the same thing in the same market area. A market survey could indicate which of these companies is perceived to be the number one very best company in that industry in that marketplace. The survey could also determine which company would rank as number two, number three, and so on. What the evidence shows is that the companies that are perceived to be the highest quality companies in any marketplace are also the most profitable companies in that marketplace. This is because of the deep need that people have for security. Whenever a person has to make a choice between a higher-priced product and a lower-priced product, if he can possibly afford it, he will choose the higher-priced product because a higher price is associated with greater quality. The perception of better quality reduces the feeling of uncertainty or risk in making the buying decision. That's why it's said if you can afford to buy quality, you can't afford not to. There's almost always a direct relationship between the amount that you pay and the quality of the product or service that you receive. You very seldom get good quality at a low price. You never get something for nothing. You always get what you pay for. In a competitive society, you can pretty much know for sure that the higher price will assure you a higher level of quality and a lower level of risk. It gives customers a greater security to purchase a high-priced, high-quality product than they would have if they saved a little money and bought a lower-quality item. There's a saying by Thomas Ruskin, "The bitterness of poor quality is remembered long after the pleasure of low price has been forgotten." Wherever you are in the quality rankings, and almost everyone knows where they are, even without a survey, you must commit yourself and your company to the number one position. You must commit to becoming the very best in your chosen field. Aim for quality leadership. Not only will it animate and excite everybody in the organization to be committed to such a worthwhile goal, but it will reflect in the profits that flow to your bottom line. The highest quality company is the company that earns the greatest profits and represents the greatest opportunities for the future. The most successful companies under all economic conditions are those that continually innovate and bring out new products and new services, even when business is slow. The sixth law of business is the law of obsolescence, which states that whatever is already becoming obsolete. The law of obsolescence says that products, services, advertisements, marketing strategies, and every other plan or policy in an organization, except perhaps for the bedrock philosophy upon which the company was formed, is becoming obsolete with rapid speed. This means that you and your company must be fast on your feet and prepared to accept continual change as an unavoidable fact of life. The first part of the law of obsolescence says that tomorrow will be different from today. The most frustrated people in the world of business are those who are trying to hold back the tide by failing to adapt or by adapting too slowly to the competitive onslaught that's taking place all around them. The second part of this law says that continuous innovation and improvement are essential to survival. They are not luxuries or activities to be engaged in when there's sufficient time and money. Every company must have top-quality people who are absolutely dedicated full-time to developing the products and services of tomorrow. If a company doesn't do this, it will end up having no tomorrow. It will simply be passed by competitors who are eager to take the business. There's a direct relationship between the quantity of new ideas the company comes up with and the ultimate financial success of the business. So, innovate, innovate, innovate. The third part of the law of obsolescence says that the best way to predict the future is to create it. Be like Walt Disney, who, when he was asked if he was worried about people stealing his ideas, replied by saying, "We'll come up with new ideas faster than anyone can possibly steal them." This should be your philosophy as well. You should always have more ideas for good products and services to bring to the market than you possibly have resources to develop them all. You should always be forced to select among a variety of possibilities to choose the ones that have the greatest market potential at that moment. By the way, a person working for a company can often see a need for a product or service that can revolutionize both the company and that individual's life. For example, a scientist at 3M Corporation in Minnesota who sung in the local church choir was having a tough time getting a bookmark to stick in the pages of his hymn book. He experimented with a variety of glues, looking for an adhesive that would enable a piece of paper to stick on and come off several times without leaving a mark or losing its stickiness. He came up with what we call today post-it notes. The company now dominates the market for stick-on notes and sells several $100 million worth of these notes each year. And the gentleman who came up with the idea has now become a wealthy man. The seventh law of business is the law of innovation, which is closely tied to the law of obsolescence. It states that all breakthroughs in business come from innovation, from offering something better, cheaper, faster, newer, or more efficient in the current marketplace. In Peter Drucker's marvelous book, Innovation and Entrepreneurship, he talks about the seven major sources of innovation, and he gives a variety of ideas on how to make innovation a way of life, both for yourself and for your corporation. Remember, all you need is one good idea, either within your company or on your own, to start you on the eighth law of business is the law of critical success factors. It's based on research summarized in a Harvard Business Review article in 1982. This law says that every business has approximately 5 to 7 critical success factors, the performance of which determine the success or failure of the enterprise. Critical success factors are like the vital functions of the body, such as heart rate, respiratory rate, blood pressure, brainwave activity, and so on. They are all indicators of life and vitality, and the absence of any one of them, even for a few moments, signals the death of the organism. Companies also have critical success factors, many of which they have in common and some of which are individual to each organization. Some of the most common critical success factors could be leadership, product quality, marketing and sales, manufacturing, distribution, and finance and accounting. Excellent performance is necessary in every one of these areas for a company to enjoy excellent results. Poor performance or non-performance in any one of these areas can actually threaten the life of the enterprise. For example, according to Dun & Bradstreet, 46% of business failures in the United States are triggered by a drop-off in sales and marketing and sales revenue. This, then, is a critical success factor or a vital function of the business. The first part of this law says that every individual also has critical success factors, the performance of which determines his or her success. Each person, including yourself, has a set of core skills or core competencies that he uses like tools to do his job. A weakness or a failure in any one of a person's core skills can render that person incapable of doing his job correctly. For example, problem solving and decision making is a critical function of every manager and every executive. If a person is physically ill or going through an extremely emotional period in his life, that person may not be capable of solving problems intelligently or making good decisions. Everyone who then depends upon that person for these abilities can have their own performance curtailed. An entire department can grind slowly to a halt because of a malfunction in a critical success factor of a single person. A single weakness in one of the critical success factors of selling can cause a person to sell only a small part of which he is capable. In many companies, the sales force has been poorly trained, or not trained at all, and the senior management is beside themselves wondering why they're not getting the kind of sales that they need in order for the company to survive and grow. Sometimes, a little sales training in the areas of critical success factors can double or even triple the average sales of a particular organization. To determine your critical success factors, you can ask yourself two sets of questions. You should repeat them every day as long as you are in the world of work. The first of these sets of questions is, why am I on the payroll? What have I been hired to accomplish? What results am I responsible for? The second set of questions you need to ask yourself is, what can I and only I do that, if done well, will make a real difference to my company? What is the one thing that I and only I can do that can really help my company, that can make an extraordinary difference in my results? These two questions, why am I on the payroll, and what can I and only I do that, if done well, will make a real difference, should be asked of every single person in the organization on a regular basis, so that everyone is absolutely clear about the answers. This is the one way to assure that each person is performing at the necessary levels in their critical success factors. The ninth law of business is the law of the market. This states that the market is where buyers and sellers of products and services meet to set prices and determine the allocations of money, labor, natural resources, and all other factors of production. Now, the market is a fictitious place, but it represents all of the millions of buying and selling decisions that take place every day at every level of society and in every area of private and public enterprise. It's the synthesis of all these decisions by millions of customers acting out the law of expediency that determines the prices of virtually everything that's not government-controlled in our society. The first part of the law of the market says that, according to the efficient market thesis, in a free market, resources will be allocated with complete efficiency and prices will accurately reflect supply and demand to that moment. This efficient market thesis is usually applied to the stock market, and it says that all stock prices at the close of each day will accurately reflect all the information that is known about the present and future prospects of the company represented by the shares. This thesis also suggests that knowledge of changing prices will spread rapidly to the people whose economic interests might be affected. The second part of the law of the market says that the free market is the most efficient way for millions of people to have their needs met at the lowest possible cost. The free market exists automatically in the absence of government controls on wages, prices, or economic activities. The freer the market, the more vibrant the economy, and the greater amount of wealth and opportunity that's created. In Hong Kong, for example, the highest tax rate on income is 15%, and there are virtually no government regulations aside from traffic and police protection. Hong Kong is a tiny area with no natural resources and with approximately 5 million people living in a small space. Nevertheless, in the absence of government interference, it is one of the most buoyant economies in the world, and it's produced countless millionaires and several billionaires. Even today, Hong Kong is actually suffering a labor shortage because of its level of economic activity. The third part of the law of the market says that the freer the market is from government interference, the greater will be the supply and the variety of goods and services, and the greater will be the prosperity of the people. Every attempt to interfere with the freedom of the marketplace is done for a reason that sounds good, the law of duality, but the real reason is always that it benefits special interests and penalizes the customer by forcing the customer to pay more for a product or service than he or she would have if the market was free. To put it another way, interference in the marketplace never reduces prices for anyone on any product or service at any time. The 10th law of business is the law of specialization, which is closely tied to the law of the market. It says that to succeed in a competitive marketplace, a product or service must be specialized and excellent at satisfying a clearly defined need of the customer. It must be clear what the product is designed to do and who the product is designed to do it for. The law of specialization also says that companies fail when they no longer specialize or serve a sufficient number of customers in a cost-efficient way. Specialization is the starting point of successful marketing. It must be made clear what it is you are offering and for whom. The 11th law of business is the law of differentiation, which states that a product must have an area of uniqueness that makes it stand out from its competitors in some way if it's to succeed in the marketplace. It cannot be a me-too product. It has to have special strengths or qualities that make it different and better than any of the other products or services which can be used as a substitute for it. The first part of the law of differentiation says that the determination of a unique selling proposition is the beginning of all successful advertising and sales. A company should be able to summarize what makes its product or service unique and different in 25 words or less. For example, Ivory Soap was famous for many years for its simple advertisement which said 99.44% pure. Ivory followed up with the advertisement, "It floats." Volkswagen, when competing against the large American cars, came up with an advertising line emphasizing its unique selling proposition which said, "Volkswagen, it makes your house look bigger." The very best marketing, advertising, and selling campaigns are built around a unique selling proposition that can be communicated in a meaningful way to the prospective customer. The second part of the law of differentiation says that to survive and thrive in the marketplace, a product or service must have a competitive advantage, something that makes it superior to competing products and services. The determination of the competitive advantage of the product or service is perhaps the most important single marketing and selling decision made by a company or organization. Whether it's a national newspaper like USA Today or a candidate for political office, the advertisers must create a meaningful competitive advantage that gives the prospective customer a good reason to buy that product rather than buying something else. Jack Welch of General Electric has said that his philosophy is to be either number one or number two in every market area in which General Electric competes. And he goes on to say, if you don't have competitive advantage, don't compete. So a good question is, what is your competitive advantage? In what way or ways is your product or service better or superior to that of your competitors? If you don't have a competitive advantage, what could it be? What should it be? Without a competitive advantage, the product or service is doomed in the marketplace. The 12th law of business is the law of segmentation, which says that companies must target specific customer groups or market segments if they are to achieve significant sales. We are rapidly reaching the end of the mass market. Today, the most successful companies are those which have been able to identify specific segments of the marketplace for whom they design individualized products and services to satisfy special groups of needs and tastes. One of the reasons that the Ford Mustang was so successful was because it was the first car that could be customized with so many different colors and accessories that almost every single Mustang was unique and different. This satisfied the individual's craving to own an automobile that stood out rather than one that was lost in the crowd. The first part of the law of segmentation in business is that many companies fail because they're targeting the wrong market with the wrong product in the wrong way. Many companies start off targeting their advertising and sales at a particular market segment only to find that the products are being purchased by a different market segment altogether. Light pickups were originally designed for construction work and hauling small quantities of materials around. However, they became extremely popular with young people as sports vehicles for going to the beach in the mountains. For many years, the German beer Löwenbräu, a high-priced import, tried to compete with American beers such as Budweiser and Miller. Löwenbräu tried every conceivable form of advertising, and they were still unable to break into markets which were tied up by the big breweries. Finally, they changed their marketing strategy and began targeting men and women with higher incomes. The first advertisement they came out with this new strategy, changed the whole history of imported beer in the United States. It simply said, "When you run out of champagne, order Löwenbräu." By positioning themselves against champagne rather than against lower-priced beer, they created a perception that imported beer was something to be drunk by people who could afford only the best. The second part of the law of segmentation says that the ideal market segment contains those customers for whom the product's competitive advantage satisfies their most pressing needs. The whole purpose of market research is to answer the question, who? Who is your ideal customer? Why does the customer buy? Why does the customer refrain from buying? Why does the customer buy from your competitor? The more accurate you are about the customer you're trying to create and keep, the more focused will be your marketing efforts, and the more likely your company will be successful in the marketplace. The 13th law of business is the law of concentration. It states that market success comes from concentrating single-mindedly on selling to those customers for whom the product's area of differentiation is the most valuable and important. To use the examples of Lexus and Infiniti, these two cars compete in a specific market niche or segment, and their marketing efforts are concentrated on selling to those men and women who can afford and will pay for a luxury car in the $35,000 to $45,000 price range. These are generally well-paid, upscale, college-educated, white-collar professionals. These are men and women who admire the BMW and the Mercedes-Benz, but for whom these cars are just out of their price range. The car manufacturers know that the further down the price curve they can go, the greater the number of potential customers who can buy their product. While BMW and Mercedes fight it out for the customers who can pay $50,000 to $75,000 for a car, Lexus and Infiniti have decided to come in below cars like Jaguar and position themselves in the same area as the highest price American cars, and their strategy is working for them remarkably well. The first part of the law of concentration says that one of the best high-profit strategies is to dominate a specific market niche with the best product available for those customers in that niche. One example of dominating a specific market niche with a high-quality product is the strategy pursued by the Cross Pen Company. CrossPens have managed to position themselves in the minds of American business people as the premier high-quality American business pen. They have pens that range from black all the way up to 18-karat all-gold. No matter how much Parker or Montblanc pens attempt to make inroads in the business market, the CrossPen is considered worldwide to be the quality pen for that particular market niche, and it has made the CrossPen company one of the most successful and profitable small companies in the world. The second part of the law of concentration says that concentration on high-profit market segments with high-profit products gives the highest return on sales, return on investment, and return on equity. This principle says that the most profitable companies in America are those companies selling high-profit products in high-profit markets. American car companies make their largest profits on cars such as the Chrysler Imperial, the Ford Lincoln Continental, and the Cadillac by General Motors. The companies that manufacture the very best, highest quality, most expensive products invariably earn the highest possible profits on the sales of those products. Rolex Watch Company is another example of this. The 14th law of business is the law of excellence, which says that the market always pays excellent rewards for excellent performance, excellent products, and excellent services. The first part of the law of excellence says that the market pays average rewards for average performance and below average rewards for below average performance. The market is a just taskmaster. It is always fair. It is always equitable. It always reflects the true expressed intentions of the customers. It always rewards those who serve it with the goods and services it wants at prices it's willing to pay, and it always punishes those companies who refuse to do so by simply declining to buy their offerings. The key to your earning excellent rewards in your career is to become excellent at performing your critical success functions in satisfying your most important customers. The keys to business success have always been the same. 1,000 books have been written and countless articles have been published, but they all eventually come down to what I call the basic five. First, the product or service must be ideally suited to the existing market and to what people want and need and are willing to pay for. Products that are not ideally suited to the existing market must change quickly or run the risk of disappearing. Second, there must be a company-wide focus on marketing, sales, and revenue generation. The most important energies of the most talented people in the company must be centered on the customer and on selling more to ever larger numbers of customers. The failure to do this is the number one cause of business collapse in any economy. Third, there must be efficient internal systems of bookkeeping, accounting, inventory management, and cost control. Losing control of internal costs and internal operations is the number two reason for business failure. Fourth, there must be a clear sense of direction and a high level of synergy and teamwork among the managers and staff in the organization. The company should function like a well-oiled machine with a place for everyone and everyone in their place performing at their best. And fifth, the company should never stop learning, growing, innovating, and improving. The Japanese call this process Kaizen. Edward Deming, the father of quality, is convinced that continuous training and upgrading at all levels of the company is the key to achieving meaningful competitive advantage and to business success. The American free enterprise system, where you and I and anyone else has the freedom to enter the marketplace to attempt to serve customers with goods and services in better ways or at cheaper prices than anyone else, is the finest system ever evolved for the satisfaction of needs and the creation of opportunity. You can take your place in this system by offering a product or service that people want and are willing to pay for. By practicing these laws of business, you can build a successful company that brings you all the rewards and satisfactions you desire in life.